down the railroad track. It makes me feel so doggone blue to listen to that old smokestack. Drivers are rolling on, leaving me here behind. Give me back them good old days and let me ramble down the line. That lonesome train, I love to hear the whistle blow. She's taking the sun and leaving the rain and making me want to go. I've got the blues, longing for her company. Many miles from where I am to the only one for me. It's so lonesome here, waiting for the manifest. I hope that engineer is kind enough to let me be his guest. Pal to me, take me everywhere I want to go, get my transportation free.
Okay. This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WEFT Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial. We have a guest again today, is Kurt Tucker, and he used to co-own the Verde Gallery, and we'll talk to him in a moment. But I wanted to say you just have been listening to Aretha Franklin. So in passing, we lost two greats this week, Aretha and Kofi Annan, who was Secretary General of the United Nations, and they both made an impact on the world. So I also want to remind you that there's an anniversary for the historic museum, the Cattle Bank on First Street, coming up next weekend, and we'll make another announcement about that at the end. But just think about attending that. Historic museums don't survive very well. So it needs all the support you can get. T.J. Blakeman is president, and he gives excellent tours around the city. So let's go to... Oh, I want to say that the Boneyard, if you go from University Avenue, has cardinal plants that are out in bloom at the moment, and they're rather wonderful. So if you're thinking of taking a walk or a run in the detention pond on 2nd Street, it's there. So now we'll transit to Kurt Tucker, who we had on last week. So we're going to do some things that are different, perhaps include a little bit of last week. First of all, I would like to, Kurt, say something about the Verde Gallery, how I got to put it together, and when he moved out and went to the Southwest, New Mexico and Santa Fe. How did that transit? So
hello, and yes, it's Kurt Tucker, but it's also Art Tucker, depending on where you live. And we did talk a little bit about Verde Gallery last week, but Dave asked me a few more questions, and I kind of explained the process and progress of what happened. It was open for several years, and I was very interested in the Southwestern artists, primarily contemporary Native American artists and also Hispanic artists. So we had some really wonderful shows with artists from the New Mexico and Arizona area. One of them was DeHaven Solomon Chaffins. She was a Zuni painter and an incredible artist. We did two shows for her, which basically sold out by the end of both shows. We had a lot of customers coming from Chicago, actually, to purchase those works. We also had a wonderful artist, a lithographer from Los Angeles, who now lives back in Mexico. He was actually from Mexico, lives in the southwestern part of Mexico. And his work was wonderfully accepted, and people, he couldn't make enough prints for the show that people enjoyed them that much. And he kept shipping them afterwards so that people could continue to purchase them.
I think
He was making some right here.
Right here, yes.
Yes, because people wanted them so much. It was unusual art for this area, and I think people really related to it. It has that, you know, the contemporary Native American artists. There's traditional Native American artists as well, and they do traditional sorts of work, you know, passed through their ancestry. But there's contemporary Native American artists who are just wonderful throughout the Southwest. And that's what we were looking for. My business partner Karen and I both went out there at times to meet and convince these folks to come to Champaign and allow us to sell their work.
You also looked at your own upbringing in Olney and brought people from Southern Illinois.
I did, yes. There were
musicians as well as
that's right.
Authors.
Musicians and authors. And music was a part of Verde all along. We had a wonderful monthly program where the local bluegrass artists who were, I don't know if they're still around, actually, because I haven't been here for so long, but
yes.
What a wonderful, fantastic group of musicians who performed every month at Verde.
So if you were looking at your gallery, you closed in the long run because you wanted to do other things.
I did. I wanted to move on to do other things. And I actually, at that point is when I was doing some free things. I had been a therapist for a long time before Verde Gallery. And I wanted to just help people out online. So I was doing free stuff, and it turned into, as I mentioned last week, into an actual business. That now I have a business partner, Mari Angulo, who is from Mexico, but also grew up in Albuquerque, New Mexico. So that business, I, after having gone out to New Mexico, Santa Fe, Taos, Albuquerque, quite a bit to look for artists, I had really enjoyed my time there, so I ended up moving there, and that's one of the reasons why Verde closed. I wanted to do some other things, and have lived there for almost 8 years, and it's a very interesting place. New Mexico in general is a place where people go specifically to remake themselves. Not always successfully, but sometimes quite successfully. It was one of the states that didn't have statehood because they didn't want it for a very long time. It was a territory, and it has always been known as a place where people go to restart their lives and become something different. And it's still very much that. While Santa Fe is, and a lot of it is owned by very wealthy people who live there two weeks a year, there's still all that sort of excitement about going to New Mexico and going to Albuquerque, Santa Fe, Taos, all those places, and starting a new life. That's
well, you
still
have a
very
terrain,
much.
You have a mountain.
Santa Fe is right at the base of the Santa Fe National Forest and the mountains that are part of that. It's right at the base. A lot of people go out there thinking it's going to be the Southwest. There's no snow, there's no this, there's no that. But that's not true. Uh-huh. Actually, it snows during the winter. Now, it goes away pretty quickly, but it still snows and snows quite a bit at times.
We have artists, authors from here, Zane Grey, I think, had a a plot in the mountains.
There's a Zane Grey Gallery in Santa Fe.
So if you look at Verde and you look at the town, which you know Champaign and Havana pretty well, I was yesterday recording on a video some of the Taste of Champaign. We started that long ago as Art in the Park, and it's gradually morphed into a very successful Taste of Champaign with food and refreshments and people meeting each other. And part of it is people meeting each other and music and dance. And so knowing that we have many different venues where you can show your art on the wall, but we're lacking, we also have a Boneyard Festival where a lot of people are showing in different places during a weekend. But if you were thinking to establish a gallery, do you have any suggestions for how we could get people together in one location? It may not be going back to Art in the Park. It may be something like your pop-up.
The pop-up galleries, which I think could be really beneficial.
That's empty space that you organize for art. It might be for a week or a month, but you get quite a few artists together.
Right, you bring artists together. It's important to allow young artists who have not had the opportunity to show their work, to give them some sort of venue, even if it's for a short period of time, to be able to show their work. And that happens quite a bit in Santa Fe, as I mentioned last week. Pop-up galleries happen, and that works like this. So there's real estate that's sitting there. The owner doesn't have anyone that's leasing it at the time. And you can lease it for a few weeks at a reasonable price and put together an art show. And it's a temporary art show.
Yes. One of the things you have to do is advertise it very well, because otherwise it's in a...
And that's something that our company does. We do publicity and marketing, and it takes that. If that isn't there, it's going to be pretty difficult to get people to come in. But if there's all of the avenues that need to be, for instance, WEFT, you know, someone coming on talking about a show that's going to happen at an empty space in 2 weeks, social media, all of those things, all of the avenues for marketing and publicity should be done with things like that. And it doesn't have to cost a lot to do that either.
Yeah. Well, when you went to New Mexico, you were dealing with different populations of people, Hispanics, some of them there from time immemorial.
Yes, when Spaniards.
Spaniards and even native people before that.
That's right.
Can you say a little bit more about that and how that morphs into Mexico?
Santa Fe is a city of different ethnicities, and... They try pretty hard to celebrate each. So there's Hispanic-related celebrations, there's Native American-related celebrations, there's all sorts of things like that that happen throughout the year. And they recognize that diversity as being a real strength. It's also a sanctuary city, and they got hassled a lot about that recently, you can imagine. Being a sanctuary city means that you don't stop people and ask them for their citizenship. That does not happen in Santa Fe. So
you also said that New Mexico hasn't destroyed all its natural vegetation. So birding is quite a big deal.
Yeah, one of the reasons why there are throughout New Mexico a lot of tourists is because the variety of bird life there is incredible. So that is a true draw for New Mexico.
And that's tremendously important, because we need that genetic pool to continue. And unfortunately, in the mid-latitudes where agriculture is big, the bird life has dwindled a lot. And the tropics are alive with bird life. Unfortunately, they are also being demolished. And so how do we convince people to not move into their territory and take the resource that really keeps the ecology alive?
One of the advantages that New Mexico has is it has very large areas of non-populated space. So, and it's often not conducive to building houses and buildings, and so a lot of it is open space and unused space other than for the wildlife, rather than.
So you do have some off-road vehicles that can actually destroy that.
That's right, and they deal with that a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, the Santa Fe National Forest is a pretty pristine forest. It's absolutely beautiful. And they do have to be very careful about who gets in there and what they do.
And you have to deal with military, which has a Alamogordo base there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that takes a lot of land, too. But if you're careful, you can deal with military things without necessarily destroying the landscape. In fact, it keeps it together often.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think people are very conscious about all that. So the wild spaces are kept pretty wild, and there's a just a real culture of hiking and camping and people experiencing nature. That's part of it. In Santa Fe, they don't build a building any larger than the St. Francis Cathedral because they want people to be able to stand in the middle of the plaza and see the mountains around them.
Well, you introduced, since you have a therapy background, it's morphed into art and left the therapy some, but you are excited about finding people who have a passion for things. Say something about that, because I see it happening in schools. I see it happening in a lot of different places where one of the main aims of the university is to encourage people to think, to dream, to observe, and to translate that into a passion for it. It might be if you have a limited capacity, you have a peak for a certain thing, or say something about
that. Well, I think that, it's rather cliche to say, do what you love. However, it often works. In my case, I left the field of mental health and was no longer a therapist, and I wanted to do some things to help people. That's part of what Verde was about. It was about helping artists, local artists, but also artists from all over, because I've had a passion for art all my life. I've created art all my life. And so Verde was really that, and I had a wonderful business partner, Karen, at the time, who was willing to let me kind of do what I wanted to do with that and make it something really pretty important. So it was about helping artists, really, and helping that scene in this town, because I knew that there were quite a few great artists here and around Illinois as well. And again, even after leaving that my passion for helping people continued through the free work I was doing for ended-up companies from around the world, the Himalayan Youth Foundation, and companies in Florida and Mexico and all over the place. It eventually turned into this love of assisting people turned into a real business that's successful. And I really think that, you know, Dave is a great example of that. Dave came to the United States from Australia. You know, he was seeking out the prairie lands that he thought would be here, and they weren't. And Dave's passion to re-prairie parts of this state has flowed out to other areas, to other organizations, to the state itself. His success in doing that can't be measured by acres of land that's happened, but by the very fact that this man came here and with a passion made people understand what was here, what could be here again, and how important it actually was with biodiversity and all of those things.
At the outset, I regarded the word passion as a sort of almost extreme, and I was not attuned to that, but after working with the Art Institute, where they use that word quite a lot, and I got to be more at home with it and could use it and teach others how to do it. Even if it's dumpster diving, I would teach people how to rig up a plot so that they could get in and salvage stuff. And so, yes, the passion is very helpful. But you have a passion for looking at other people in other parts of the world.
I do.
So say something about how that impinges on what you do and how you help to collate things or organize for people when they are not quite sure of themselves.
Well, one of the things I've been doing for the past few years since I left Champaign is traveling a lot. When I first moved to Santa Fe, it was my intention to buy a home, despite the fact that it's pretty hard to buy homes in Santa Fe because they're so expensive. That was my goal. And my business partner, who had come back from Mexico, she was studying international business, her name is Madi, convinced me that wouldn't it be a better idea not to buy a house but to travel. And it took me a while to get used to that idea, but eventually I went, that makes perfect sense. Let's do that. So we have spent the past several years traveling all over the world. Now, probably most of the time in Mexico, but also throughout Europe, Morocco, all over the world, really. And my appreciation of other cultures has just expanded by that, by doing those things, by doing all that traveling. I always had a goal in wherever we went, and there were two, and that's to understand the history of the place and also to experience the art of each place. So whether it be in Sweden at the Moderna Museum, which is a fabulous, fabulous museum, or the Louvre, or throughout Barcelona, Spain, the public art. All of those things were really important, and again, it was sort of an extension of my love of art and my desire to experience that in all the ways that I could.
So people don't always have that opportunity to move, but then their landscape that they're in becomes unique and interesting. And we have a state that has 13 different ecosystems, from Bald Cypress in the south, which is like a bayou, to very alpine ecosystems to the north, and then we have gravelly, sandy, swampy different ecosystems. And people like Jefferson, his partner, are in books, and you can visit. And tourists have enough time these days to be very interested in the places that they go to. So the little town we go into has a history because it's near a railroad, or so you start to look at the town and figure out, and those towns are changing because of internet. You just told me a while ago that your 90-year-old mother is on the internet
all the time. She is.
So translate your international movements to a local situation. What do you find with a twinkle in your eye when you go back to Aldi?
Well,
mentioning a theater. There was a theater.
There was a theater in Aldi, and it closed a couple of years ago, and that was a blow to the town. Everyone has to drive to Vincennes, Indiana to go see a movie now. However, there's a place called Ophelia's Cup, this wonderful cafe that this woman opened. It's a coffee shop, and they have espresso. You're not going to find espresso anywhere else in Aldi than Ophelia's Cup. And it's become a hub, a community social hub for the town unlike other restaurants, it's a place where everybody goes, everybody sits around and talks with each other.
It's a little bit like Cafe Kopi.
It is. It's a little bit like Cafe Kopi, which I think is a wonderful place here in Champaign.
Meeting Coulson, who was mayor of Mahomet the other day. We'd done some prayer things together. It just is wonderful that just being there together. So humans like togetherness. And so when you go to other countries, you have a little of the language. You probably, people enjoy, even if you can't do it right, you have a little.
They appreciate you trying.
Yes.
Even if they make fun of you, they still appreciate
it.
So I was talking to Dave earlier today when we were sitting at Cafe Kopi having a coffee about how the internet has changed travel. Airbnb is a wonderful thing. You get to stay in an actual home rather than a hotel for a period of time and experience that as if you live there. There's an app called Eat With Me, which we have used, and we've had wonderful experiences throughout Europe, sitting down and having dinner with people in their home, and which is a completely different experience than going to a restaurant. We've met some wonderful people. I know people who I have now met throughout Europe, and I met them on Instagram. And we have arranged to be with them at times, to do things with them. They have seen me taking photos in some place in Europe and said, "Hey, you're here? Wow. We want to come and see you." The internet has changed travel in so many different ways, whether it's navigation or whether it's finding a place to be and stay or eating with people or doing things with people, events with people that you would not otherwise know. It's really changed the possibilities of what you can do. You know, you were talking about understanding this environment, Dave. Well, ecotourism is a huge industry now.
Yes,
people
and it's
are
a very
specifically
important one.
Going to places to experience the landscape. Like Dave's Reading the Landscape series, which has always been so important. So Dave's already been doing that, and he's been doing it for Champaign County for a long time. And now it's become vogue to go to places and see all these things and understand them.
You have organic farmers, and they are meeting on the internet. And it's criticized a lot for
the negatives.
The negatives, but there's also a lot of positives, and we've enjoyed doing that. So if you go to Paxton, can you imagine a small industry where people would exchange homes with tourists? They're Scandinavian based. Do you get to learn about the Scandinavian background? Do you find the Main Street reasonably intact?
It's actually, Paxton's a beautiful little town. Yes. Dave and I were there the other day traveling around in and around Paxton and Rantoul to look at the remnants of prairie, which was really fascinating. Beautiful little remnants of prairie that he mostly has preserved.
Oh, there's a lot of people that are involved. Some of the things we do is just inspire some interest. And so, yeah, it's there. How would you think about, we have a Natchez Trace. We have traces that go north and south across the country and east and west across the country. And bicyclists especially are using these. And then they drop in and they bring a little tourist money to restaurants. But they are interested in finding out what Friends Creek is about or Allerton Park or the railroads, where were they, and what is this museum that's on the Nickel Plate Line, which has now been abandoned? How does that run to Gibson City? And just knowing the moraines and what they look like, and they're compared with the mountains that you have in New Mexico, they're very gentle, but they tell a story. How can we encourage that? So as a consultant, how would you suggest we go from north to south to have a subsidiary trail that might be like unto a natural, but interact with it?
I think that that section of Old 45 that you took me to, that you have prairie on the side, on along the side, a beautiful, beautiful patch of vibrant prairie, and then on the right-hand side was the pathway of the interurban rail that went between the little towns and cities of Illinois.
Yes.
I think it's a fascinating area,
it
and
has
I think it's
enough space with the gravel pit that we bought for 9 acres, plus the interurban, plus the railroad line nearby, plus an old retired Route 45, and it goes 10 miles. And one of the things we have to be careful to do is to not generate too many great dreams. We might have dreams behind, but the important thing is to do some local things that are doable in your lifetime, so that you see what you're contributing to and how it affects other people. So I think that's one of the things would be to go between Rantoul and Pax and not even bother about going to Kankakee, which is also an interesting place. So something that's doable. So then as a coordinator, as a person who to some extent I manage in lobbies, how could we talk to the Department of Transportation and Department of Natural Resources to reconstitute that 10 miles? I don't know. You made some comments to the fact that you work with not-for-profit organizations, because sometimes that's more successful than working with...
Right. And I think I noticed the other day that when you took me to that cemetery where there is really beautiful prairie, that whole section, that it was the Department of Natural Resources that's maintaining that.
Yes.
And I think that section, that 10-mile section of trail, given the right plans, the right people involved, and, you know, the right kind of funding coming from various sources, I think that would be a true asset to the state of Illinois to have Route 10,
yes,
cleaned up, fixed up, reprairied, as you've been doing. And I think it could be truly an eco-tourist, fascinating area.
It ties into some east-west railroad beds that have been restored as rail trails. So there's a trail on what used to be called the Punkinland Vine Line between Rantoul and the township area. 3 miles. It's just 3 miles, but it's being used as a trail. And there's open space that goes with yards and things like that. You also seem to have your finger on the fact that we need money to do these sorts of things. So you have found money to do some of these sorts of things.
In some cases.
To work with authors or... say something more about authorship, because lots of people have information that would be wonderful for people, children to read. It might be written at a child's level.
Well, we work with a lot of different authors, fiction and nonfiction. And authors are very dedicated people. They're good people to work with because they're so dedicated to what they do. And they would like their message, whether it be, again, fiction or nonfiction, to get out there. Books are wonderful learning tools. They know that. And they know that they're writing for a purpose. We work with a lot of authors. Some of them are first-time authors. Some of them are best-selling authors. They're dedicated people.
Do they have to have 10 years to do a book?
Sometimes.
Or can the book come off their chest fairly quickly? It just so what some people write music
well,
quickly.
And people That really varies. Some people, it does take 10 years to write a book. Sometimes it takes, you know, less than a year to write a book. I've had a little bit of interaction with Cormac McCarthy, who lives outside of Santa Fe. You will probably remember the movie No Country for Old Men. He's an incredible writer, somebody I've appreciated for a long time. What he says, interestingly, is somehow these books get written in my head, and then I sit down, and it's almost dictated from my brain, and it doesn't take me any time to write the book.
Yes, so, there's authors that sit down to write, and their characters take off in a different direction than they expected.
Yes.
So there's a creativity in here. So does Santa Fe provide that sort of atmosphere where people like to find a niche?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, it's artists. Often people go to Santa Fe because of the art, not knowing that there's probably more, if not as many, writers in Santa Fe as there are artists. You know, the art is much more visible, of course, so they don't really know all these people who live in the hills who are writing books, and some of them, again, are best-selling authors.
So now if you go to Mexico and you find people who are excited about climbing a mountain, I've been to Popocatépetl, I don't know, I'm not saying it properly, but there are high-rise volcanic mountains outside of Mexico City, and you see people living their lives in an interesting manner. What do you say to them? How do they leave their credentials? Is it oral? Are they going to sing or play music into another generation?
I think the diversity of Mexico is stunning. And its creativity. I've spent quite a bit of time because of Mari in Mexico, and I know that many of your listeners are not going to need to be disabused of this notion, but some may. People in Mexico are perfectly happy being in Mexico. Many are very successful. Many are successful at making a good life. They have no intention of moving to the United States. And we see all that happening now. We hear about all this. And in most cases, these are not people that are coming from Hermosillo, Mexico, who want to move to Arizona or New Mexico or someplace. They have no intention of that. They're perfectly happy living where they live.
They're coming from Guatemala or some other place.
They're coming
through Mexico.
Through terrible circumstances out of, yes, the southern part of, in South America and various places. So that qualification that all these people are Mexicans coming across the border is not really actually true. I've spent a lot of time there, and I know a lot of people in Mexico who live very good lives in varying degrees of either wealth or poverty. They still, you know, they're very, very hardworking, ingenious people who
have a lot of fun doing some of the things that they're doing.
That's right. And, you know, they live in a culture, too, that absolutely believes in sustainability in many cases, because you know, you don't throw away your phone, you get it fixed at the shop down the street.
Yes.
You don't throw away your washing machine because it stopped, ever. It gets fixed. For as long as it needs to get, as many times as it needs to get fixed, it gets fixed. So that's something I really appreciated, the understanding that, you know, we are throwing everything away. Why are we?
Yes. We are well aware that the Aztecs and others reached the point of utilizing their nation and their resources to the point that they tended to fail. And that's happened in many places around the world. So I think the simplicity is often very generous, because those people are not fishing the seas free of certain species. They're not taking down the trees. They're, they're managing the landscape in a much more sustainable manner. And they probably don't use a lot of chemicals.
And not only that, Mexico, the country has more untapped natural resources than any other country in the world. So they're not actually destroying all the natural resources. They're actually using them in better ways, or not using them, because they have this sense of, we can use what we have here, we can reuse it, we can repurpose yes. it.
You don't take a forest and clear cut it.
Right.
You take certain trees that might be older, and you use beasts of burden to pull the tree out with pulleys around the other trees. You don't take a huge bulldozer in and drop the whole lot. And those trees have a communication with themselves within a forest, so that you keep the forest intact. You don't take big pieces out of it. And so,
I just wanted to, before we move on from Mexico, having lived in Illinois, when I was growing up here, I was very interested in archaeology and anthropology, and I worked with some folks down in near St. Louis, Edwardsville, for a period of time doing digs. And I would ask these archaeologists and anthropologists, what happened to the Illini Indians? And they said, well, some of them said, oh, they died on the Trail of Tears. Some of them said they dispersed and were no longer a group. Uh-huh. But nobody knows what happened to them, actually, is what they tell me. So I went to Mexico and into the state of Sonora, and there's an organization called LUDASIC. And what LUDASIC does is go back to these small communities, in many cases indigenous people, and give them back some of the craft, help them regain the craft making that they had done in the past, and art-related endeavors. And I was talking to them and talking about the Illini Indians and the fact that they'd asked me where I was from, and I said Illinois, and they said, and I said, but the Illini are all gone. And they laughed and said, the Illini are not gone. They have a large village in the Sierra Madre Mountains. That's where they went. They were on the Trail of Tears, went off the Trail of Tears, and resettled in the Sierra Madre Mountains. So there actually is a town of the ancestral Illini Indians in Mexico.
I think of Southern Illinois. And we have a terminal moraine for the last Wisconsin glaciation at Effingham. And then the previous glaciations weren't so fertile. So the farming is different once you drop off the terminal moraine. But it has Shawnee forests. It has what Iowa doesn't have. Iowa doesn't have that sort of forest. So they're very big in prairie because that's their ecosystem. But here we have multiple ecosystems. And how do we encourage people from East Central Illinois to go to Southern Illinois and enjoy these spaces? One of the things you have to know is it's not enough to just preserve something if you're going to interpret it. You have to maintain it. If it's a small plot, it really has to be maintained regularly. If you have a large 10,000 acres or something like that, you don't have to be quite so worried because one thing will balance out against the other. But how do you see the extension of the trail from Rantoul to Paxton, going south to Salem and Kinmundy and Olney and Newton and Prairie Chickens, and how do you work with Carbondale and University, and Edwardsville was another university. And how are you, out of those universities are coming natural history people who really are interested in the area, and you have cultural people who know the little towns and have the stories about the dog or that was chasing the train or whatever.
And I think, Dave, you've used a lot of university resources as far as students and things like that to help
yes.
you, right?
Yes.
Throughout all these years.
It's not like you were dumping on people. The students bring their own energy, and often it's very wonderful to experience that. It might take a while for it to gel, but it's listening and perhaps adding a comment. As you get older, you have some wisdom that's not always realized, but you have a backlog of knowledge that can be transmitted nicely to young people, especially if they're interested and excited. And so, but they are very involved in their internet. They're very involved with trying to establish their career. They want to be involved with music, and often they're fewer instead of having six brothers and sisters. They might have two, so they have more responsibilities for their parents and their grandparents, so they're going to live longer. How do you take that stew and mold it and help it? It seems to be you need visitor centers, perhaps, or kiosks or directions, and it's very costly. How?
And you know, I think that again comes into the state and people of means helping, the foundations, whatever they are, the nonprofits being involved. I think that's, it takes a lot of organization, I think, to do that. Even starting a nonprofit is really tough. The paperwork you have to go through, you know that,
yes.
Dave. You've gone through that.
And there are various levels of it. You can have a fairly established not-for-profit, like the Boy Scouts or the Red Cross, and you join an organization that's already established.
Mm-hmm.
But at the other end, you have one or two people, three or four, that get together, and they're not sure where to go. They may be into a field that they don't know about. They have to learn about it. So it's sometimes as loose as a goose. And so how do you encourage those people to get together? And does that mean that they have to come together in something like the Prairie State Conservation Coalition, which has been put together to bring these sorts of people together?
I think it does. And it takes, you know, you have to have a good board. You have to have a board that's actually interested in what's going on.
Yes.
And will also reach out for you to get funding. Boards can do that if you have
yes.
a good board.
Boards can also be involved, but sometimes boards are removed from...
Sometimes they are,
The everyday thing, and you have to be able to get out there and enlist people and convince them that this might be their passion. So that goes back to where you were
talking
about.
It does go back to that.
To finding out what tickles people's soul.
Yeah,
so,
you know, I think about...
A twinkle in the eye.
I think about New Harmony. I'm sure many of you know New Harmony and have been there. This single-handedly, this one woman, I'm not remembering her name right now, turned what was left of New Harmony into something very special and a beautiful place. She recognized the history of the Rappites, the Millennial Society that lived there, and then the scientific community that lived there after that, and literally single-handedly rebuilt that entire town and turned it into something pretty darn nice.
I think she might have been a film personality.
She had some sort of
background that enabled her to do this, and she was willing to do it.
But if you want to see if you haven't been there and you want to see an example of someone's true passion, who believed that something could be turned back into something fabulous, New Harmony is a great place to look at and visit and stay and learn from.
Yes. I want to remind you that we have, this is a slight diversion, but it involves thinking out the whole process here. We have a Pour Your Own bar going in. It will probably be in action within a week or two. It has taken over our Pocket Prairie, which is understandable. It doesn't belong to us. We've been very grateful to have it for 30 years. There was a little piece at the far end that was owned differentially. And right now, we are realizing that there has to be stairwells out of the apartments on the second floor of that building. And so you might just watch our activities of the next while. We may lose the little piece of prairie that we had left on the end. And so that makes you think about niches in downtown Champaign, places where you can find out about your history, like the cattle bank. It will probably be axiomatic that the bed between Market Street and Chestnut Street will not be just a simple slope to take a wheelchair, but it will be shortened by the apparatus that's safety egress at the Market Street Inn. So all these rules and regulations are a part of what you have to deal with if you're in such a situation. It may be that we'll have to move the prairie, but if you happen to be looking right lately, take a look at the dock, the prairie dock. It must be 8 or even 10 feet tall. Its leaves are wonderful. We wonder how deep the roots are. We already moved a compass plant, and it didn't have as big a roots as we thought, and we're hoping it grows. But it's all going to the Second Street detention pond. And bless me, the rain was there the other night, and you can see where all the flotsam from mowing has risen to a level of perhaps 2 feet above the planting for the prairie. So it's wet, but prairie was used to being wet. This was the Grand Prairie, and so we hope that when we move the final little piece of prairie, it will go to perhaps a slightly higher place and be looked after by the city in perpetuity. It will need attention. I've been over there weeding, but it's the sort of thing that's a small part of a bigger boneyard attempt to prevent water from getting into the streets of Campustown so that you can row a boat on them. And that's happened, so the detention pond is successful, but some of the vegetation that's been planted is natural vegetation. So what we're doing is joining that. And there's a little plot on top of the concrete pipe that takes the boneyard across University Avenue, and right today that is got cardinal plant, which needs sort of water, so the water has to come from off the streets into that pond, which is on top of the boneyard, and then you walk just a few feet and you can look down and see the boneyard coming out and has waterfalls that are aerated, and it goes into a large pond, and that can be pumped out slowly if the and so that the water doesn't flood the campus town. And so I'm just looking. Well, you've got 5 minutes. It's other things that you might like to say. With respect to some of the things you saw yesterday, what if you were to move into consult on that sort of thing, how would it relate to Bloomington? How would it, so you have this long continental glaciation. How do you introduce people to a moraine and an outwash plain?
Well, you know, I think part of the issue with getting people to look at the sort of prairie diversity that you represent is people come to Illinois or live in Illinois and say, farmland. That's what they think. Farmland all over the place.
Yes, well, you drive down the road, it's corn on one side and soybeans on the other.
That's right.
I had my mother come from Australia and I took her to Iowa, and all of Illinois and Iowa was corn and soybeans.
I think it's hard for people to understand that there was diversity, true plant and biodiversity here that's not here anymore.
Part of it is that corn and soybeans, we didn't have corn soybeans till 1935. Agronomists were sent around the world to find the gene pool for glycine, which is the botanical name for soybeans. And so they had big ones, little ones, ones from the deserts, one. And eventually they put together soybeans. So by 1935, they had enough material that they could increase it. And now it's become a major income product for this community. But there are other plants that are not quite so productive, but they're interesting. And so we need the gene pool people, we need the geneticists to be looking at the retinue of biochemicals and materials that are in that prairie. If we wanted to say to farmers, that soybeans you have to plant each year, and it erodes, and that soil with its phosphate and its nitrogen and all its chemicals that keep the plant afloat and deny the biodiversity of the butterflies and the bees and the whatnot go down to the gulf and make it a desert zone. Can we have some other plants that might be perennial soybeans, equivalent to a new soybean that you could mow for 20 years and then replace so that you could have more rotation so that it might be a potato, but the potato might have to expand, so it's better in a sandier soil than it is in a Drummer or a Flanagan tough, very fertile soil. It might be a carrot that needs the same thing to expand. It might be that the climate is different. So do we have young people, especially, who are looking at genomes and looking at tying in different additions to them? Not just the corn and soybeans biome. We've come from corn, from Tercente, with